Blog Talk Radio.
Rise, let us be on our way. There will be days, there will be days.
Hi, this is Joseph G. with Rum Radio. We're part of the Sober Couch Recovery Network. Rum Radio, Half the Measures Room, and Sober Couch. Also like to thank recoverytoday.net. It's a magazine of recovery. It's really good. Some great articles in there. It's free on the web at recoverytoday.net, especially since they've published one of my stories, if Bill was the sail, Dr. Bob was the anchor. I think it's a great story. It gives you an idea of who these two fellas that started this worldwide event of spiritual recovery through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. We're also want to thank Big Texas Rally for Recovery in Austin, Texas. They've invited us in. That's Saturday, October 1st. Between 4 and 7 on the south lawn of the state capitol grounds. Looks like there's going to be room in there pretty soon if the governor has to move out. So we'll have plenty of room to move around. Jimmy Lee will be on the band, and we'll have Recovery Coast to Coast. We'll be Neil Scott. We'll be doing a archive show from that location. So tonight we got, and this is Joseph G. I'm a grateful person in recovery. I'm a refugee from several 12-step programs. I'm also an Alkanon, if you've ever heard that term before. If you can overdo it, do too much of it, sign me up. Tonight we're going to be talking about the bedevilments versus the promises. Somebody sent me this some time ago. I think it came from Barefoot. It's a really good website. And I had never put the two together. The promises are something that comes by. It's on the basic text of Alcoholics Anonymous called the Big Book. And in the Big Book, there's 12 steps of recovery. We consider this as a solution to the problem of addiction. And it's worked for hundreds of thousands, if not millions of folks. So we know that there is a solution, and it's available under certain circumstances. And one of the circumstances is honesty, willingness, are the two main components, and action. If you're willing to take certain actions, you're going to get certain results. Now, this is what we find. It's worked for me, so I can only tell you that it'll work for you if you strictly follow the path that we go with, that we do, and it works very well. The bedevilments are in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's on page 52. And these promises are said to come true on the ninth step. And the ninth step is about the amends process. Now, the eighth step is about willingness, and I found that most of the steps have a willingness component and then an action component. So there's a spiritual preparedness in one step and then taking action, preparing you to take that action. And step eight is the preparation, and step nine is the execution. And it's done with the consultation with God and your sponsor to see what the correct amends are make. And amends is, I tell my sponsees, is sort of like mending a garment, putting a patch on a piece of cloth. You mend it. Now, you may not get the garment exactly the way it was at the time it was torn, but you could do the very best you can to make right the wrong. And that's our goal in the ninth step. So we find out with our previous information that we've gathered and working the steps, what it would look like to make these amends. We do that in step eight. We just become willing. willing to take certain actions. We don't have to take any action other than writing them down and making suggestions after the outcome. I suggest that we, one of the criteria is there resources involved? Do you have the resource, and is the person involved, available? Do you have the resources and the person is not available? You don't have the resources and the person is available. And then the last case would be the resources are not available and the person is not available. So we refine that list to see what amends we can make now that are close and local and which ones we'll have to wait on to see when God will work that out for us. And this is within consultation with your sponsor and prayerfully with God. Now, of course, these are all suggestions. A lot of people think that they have to do these things. Well, my experience is if you do them, the chances of you staying sober long-term is greatly expanded. If you don't do them, we're only making a suggestion. As a sponsor, what I do if the person doesn't want to make an amends, well, that's their decision. I can't make that decision for him. I'm not his decision maker. But what I do is I don't put a lot of energy into the sponsee until he becomes ready to go forward with this. See, originally we agreed to go to any length to achieve sobriety. Are you willing to go to any length to achieve sobriety? That's the second question I ask a new sponsee. The first question I ask, have you had enough? And most of the time they'll say, well, what do you mean? And I'll say it a little louder, have you had enough? Usually they understand what I'm saying. Have you had enough pain? Have you had enough humiliation? Have you had enough? And if they're willing to say yes to both of those areas, then we continue on from that premise. If they can't give me an affirmative on either one, then I tell them, I'm really not the fellow for you. You need to keep coming back, and someone else probably will help you then in the future. But if you ever get to that agreement, give me a call, and we'll talk about it. So it kind of weeds out people that are just kicking tires. Some people come, they're not ready. You know, they haven't had enough pain. They're not sure if they're addicted sufficiently, that they still believe that they have the illusion of control. And that's fine. Everybody's in a different place. But I prefer to use my time on somebody who's ready to take the test drive at least. So now that we've gone through this list and we found out people that we've harmed, the amends, we've gone through step 4 and step 5 and step 6, taking away our character defects, and 7, you know, turning it over to God, 8 in the willingness, and now 9 comes. And it says with 9, the promise before, we're halfway through. Now, there's always a question about that. It comes in the big book at the 9th step. So it's alluded to the fact that halfway through the 9th step amends process, these promises will come through. But before we get the promises, back page 52, there's a section and, to wit, we had to ask ourselves why we shouldn't apply to our human problems the same readiness to change our point of view. It's about open-mindedness. The human condition, as well as the alcoholic, is the extreme, I found to be most of the time. We lock into certain ideas, ways of doing things, the way we, you know, places we sit in congregations and in places that we go regularly. We always take the same way home. It's the shortest way home, and after a while we don't even notice the scenery anymore. It just becomes kind of a blur and the quickest way to get home. So to change any of this, sometimes the older you get, the harder it is to change. How many people have heard old dog, new tricks? So we have to be ready to open our point of view and see if there's something better. Okay, so we're trying to change our point of view, but we were having trouble with personal relationships. We couldn't seem to make a connection with people. Loners, isolators, manipulators, people would catch on to us eventually, some longer than others, but eventually most people would, or we didn't want to bother with people at all. We had alcohol, we had drugs, we were good. They filled all our needs. Now, the corresponding promise, which is on page 83, so the bedevilment is we were having trouble with personal relationships. The promise, in step 9, we will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. So, and the bedevilment is personal relationships because it was all about me. If I couldn't get what I wanted or get what I needed, through fair means or foul, I didn't really need the relationship or want the relationship, and all my relationships were based on the same. So what I had to do was change my way of looking at things. But this doesn't come overnight. It's not so much a change of point of view. It's a process. The process really starts with step 1 in AA, admitting we were powerless over alcohol and our lives would become unmanageable because it was all about us. So now we're going to lose interest in selfish things. It's not about me anymore, and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. I read something from St. Francis. One of the greatest gifts from Christ was the ability to get out of self. And this is where it all comes to fruition. The second bedevilment, we couldn't control our emotional natures. We were emotional basket cases. Real high highs, real low lows. Poor me. Victimization. Always the victim. And we could never find a level playing field of emotional stability or sobriety. So if we weren't drinking or drugging or participating in some behavior, our emotions were like a ping pong table. We're always on this roller coaster, up and down, up and down. That was my experience. The promise, we will comprehend the word serenity, and we know peace. That was unheard of at the time. There was always something. I always needed something going on. I always needed some kind of distraction. I wasn't used to being in a place of serenity, calm, and peace. It was an alien place to me. It was almost frightening. I said at a meeting, I used to live in hell, but I knew where all the light switches were. So I was comfortable in hell. The promises tell me we will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. We were a prey to misery and depression. A prey? What doesn't kill you makes you less edible. Pain is a natural consequence of the flesh. We're heir to that in the flesh, to pain. But misery would be suffering, and that's really about choices. Suffering is optional, but we would take that option of misery and depression. And I've learned that depression was nothing more than anger with no enthusiasm. We were angry at the world because of all our losses, broken marriages, broken homes, wayward children, unable to make a living, poor me, pour me another drink of alcohol. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Now, that's one of the promises. We will see the world in a new light. How cool is that? I was in an Al-Anon meeting one time, and they said, your life was like living in a hula hoop. And the only thing you had control of was what was ever inside that hula hoop. And there was nothing, you had no control of anything outside of that hula hoop. So what changed? The world didn't change. Surely the hula hoop didn't change. My outlook changed. My attitude changed. I was not in control. And once I'm not in control of everything, hey, I'm freeing myself. I'm freeing myself inside the hula hoop. I'm safe inside the hula hoop. The next bedevilment was we couldn't make a living. Fear of people and economic insecurity will leave us. That's the promise. That's the corresponding promise. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. Most people have a fear of people. I mean, they're more dangerous than furniture. People always represented something, police. People were going to tell you what to do. Actually, it was really about us because we always wanted to get something from the other person. Money, time, drugs, alcohol, a ride, a job, something. So that automatically put us into a position where someone always wanted something from us. I believe that's where the fear comes in. What do they want? They want something from me. Why is this guy being nice to me? He wants something. And economic insecurity will leave us. Now, it's not saying you're going to be rich. It's not saying that you're going to have money. All it's saying is that the fear will leave us. We're going to lose the fear of people and economic insecurity. We're not going to worry about if we lose the job. If we don't have any money in our pocket, we're not going to be fearful about that because we're going to learn that God is doing for us what we couldn't do for ourselves. I've come across people in the program that wasn't making enough money to make ends meet. Just was not. The sufficient amount of money was not coming in. But lo and behold, they always made ends meet. They didn't even know how they did it sometimes. Money would come in a check. Somebody would have something, a car. Their needs were always being met when they turned their will and their lives over to the care of God. That, you know, and then if that happens long enough, what happens is that you really believe that it's going to happen. It becomes a working part of your mind. Reminds me of my first sponsor, Kenneth, in Cedar Park. Kenneth was a very interesting fella, Mensa. But you wouldn't know it to look at him. He always wore this funky jumpsuit and looked like he just got off the curb somewhere. And half the time he might have struggled with economics for a long time. I had a warehouse in Austin and in the art sculpture business. And he was putting brakes on my 4Runner. I had a Toyota 4Runner. And as he's putting on the brakes, of course I'm going to pay him, but he turned around to me, and I think this is more of a lesson. He said, I don't have enough money to buy food tomorrow. I said, oh, isn't that interesting? Now, I've never been that far down the scale. I've always been a saver, so no matter what, I've always had some money stashed somewhere to get by. I said, well, what are you going to do, Kenneth? And he said, well, I do what I always do. I work with another alcoholic, and my needs are always met. and my needs are always met when I work with another alcoholic. Wow. It became a working part of his mind. Every time he did it, it worked. And that reinforced the fact that it would work. And so now uncommon sense becomes common sense. So he had no fear about economic. He worked hard. He was a hardworking guy and married well. And last time I heard, he was still happily married and had a nice home and was back in his trade. He was a programmer, C++ or so, whatever that deal was. Way over my head. His hobbies were geology and astrophysics or something. Just kind of out there. Another bedevilment, we had a feeling of uselessness. Not good for anything. I can't really do anything. I'm just a loser. You know, the world would be better off without me. Just a nothing, a nobody. Never going to amount to anything. My dad was right. The feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. Self-pity. That's one of the big ones. That's one of the big self-pity, self-delusion, self-seeking. Me. Poor me, poor me, poor me, another drink of alcohol. The feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. Hey, it just disappeared. I feel like I'm a useful member of society. I don't feel bad about myself. I don't cry. What happened to me was I was with a doctor one time, and he gave me a prescription deal saying that I was a natural victim. That's how so convincing I was. Hello, caller. Who is this?
This is Harold B.
Oh, Harold. Okay, Harold. What do we got for Harold? There you go.
All right.
How you doing, Harold?
Calm down, everyone. Calm down. Okay. Well, I just got home, just got on the line, so it'll take me a minute to get caught up with everybody here.
Oh, yeah, we there's tons of us here. There's a cast of thousands. Well, thank you for coming on. I've been entertaining myself. You know, I tell people I have so many words and so few thoughts. This is a perfect venue for me. I become so enamored with my own voice. I can hardly stop. Matter of fact, after the show, I keep on going, and there's nobody there to listen.
Well.
I'm kidding, of course, but not by much.
Welcome.
There we go.
We're going over the bedevilments versus the promises. It's page 53 for the bedevilments and page 82 for the promises. I went over the fact where the promises come from and et cetera. Right now, let's see where we go with that. We were full of fear. Fear. What's fear, Harold?
F-E-A-R, false evidence appearing real.
Fear, yes. The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear.
Or
fear.
Someone else said it stands for F everything and run.
I heard that one. Now, there's good fear. Isn't there a good fear? I mean, if we didn't fear a grizzly bear and it was coming after us, we wouldn't run, right? Isn't that it? The fight-flight syndrome, is that based on fear?
Well, yes, and we need to fear the ocean and the riptides. Never turn your back on the ocean. There could be a sleeper wave come up. We need to fear grizzlies and have a proper respect for sharks, although usually sharks are more afraid of you than you are of them. So let's see. I'm going down the list. I'm looking at your website, rumradio.org.
Uh-huh.
And the captain's table, I found the bedevilments and the promises.
Yeah. Interesting. Had you ever seen him put across like that?
No, this is terrific. We were full of fear, and then the promises says we will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. And that really is true for me on a daily basis. Things work out, and I think back, I couldn't have even planned it that way. You know, it's beyond human planning. I really, I get a big kick out of this one in particular, how things fall together. I call it a God shot when it happens.
Do you know who Dudley is in Houston? No? You know Dudley?
I've heard of him.
One of his Dudleyisms is that I now baffle things that used to handle me.
Well, that's a good way to put it. Yeah.
I know handle things that used to baffle me. Now I baffle things that used to handle me. Yeah. That was kind of cute. And
that
the
is
key
cute.
Word, I think, is intuitively.
Yeah. Yeah, the intuition, which I've heard intuition described as God's way of staying anonymous.
I like that. God's
way. By the way,
small voice.
As a side note, I wanted to talk about how the conversation between you and me goes back and forth. I was listening to another talk show, and at the end of a paragraph by one panel member, he would say the other panel member's name, and that was a little signal that that paragraph was over and the other person should go ahead and pick up the ball and speak. Joseph. So
yes,
that would be a way that I can signal you that my paragraph is finished and you can go ahead and pick up the ball.
Okay.
Do you like that?
Yeah, I think that's as good as any. Until we come up with something else, or we can use a keyword like fire.
Fire, Joseph.
No, I don't like that. I've heard that before. I've overheard conversations with that before, so I think we'll kind of let that go.
Well, back to the topic for a second. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. I think the key there, my first sponsor taught me to, that was Paul Z, 6'5", 300 pounds. And he used to teach me to pause. And the book says pause whenever doubtful or what, agitated? But he
would teach me.
If I'm baffled, he would teach me to pause. Just pause, take a deep breath, think for a minute, and give the intuition some time to really work. Or as I've learned to put it with a scriptural reference, give Holy Spirit a moment to work. But I don't really care what you call it. The experience is the same. We intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. Joseph.
We were full of fear. Fear is probably one of the most discussed topics in recovery.
Do you think so? I think a lot of guys need to discuss it, but they're reluctant.
You didn't say Joseph.
Oh, Joseph.
I think the reason is a macho kind of deal. People, men especially, don't like to admit that they're fearful about anything. When you mention that a fear that you have, kind of lowers your macho image, even when you're speaking to yourself. You know what the number one fear is, don't you?
I think I do.
Harold?
Public speaking. I heard some survey results that said the fear of public speaking even exceeds the fear of death by dismemberment, Joseph.
I've never heard of dismemberment. They must have known one of my ex-wife's attorneys. I've heard that before. The number one fear is speaking in public, more so than the death of the body, with or without dismemberment, more so than the death of a child.
Ooh.
Which is one of the most, that's one of the hardest things you can consider. More so than a divorce, which is the death of the community, which is more so than the loss of a home or even a loss of a job. Now, all the other fears are legitimate and have a profound consequence. But speaking public at first blush doesn't seem like it has much, compared to the other one. But what I've learned is speaking in public is the number one fear, is because ridicule is death to the ego.
Yes, ridicule is the ego.
Death. And the ego will sacrifice the body on the altar of pride, a vain attempt to stay alive. The preacher said, vanity's a vanity. All is vanity.
Yes, I...
Harold?
I agree 100%. What I've done in the past is to join a nonprofit club that studies public speaking. And one of the first things that they taught us is that the entire audience is for us. It's very seldom that you'll get somebody that wants to heckle, who's not for you 100%. And then they taught us how to handle the heckler. You simply repeat what the heckler is saying. But everybody else in the audience is rooting for you. They're pulling for you. They want you to succeed. And even if the worst happened, like you peed your pants or something, they would come forward, help you get cleaned up, and help you handle the situation. People are for you. So the fear of public speaking is totally irrational. Totally. And yet we entertain all kinds of fears. I do. My experience is that I've entertained all sorts of fears, and I think it was Dr. Scott Peck that said 99.5% of them never come to pass anyway. It was all useless energy, Joseph.
Yeah, thank you, Harold. That's what I find, too, that we put so much energy into the fantasy of what might happen. I think part of it is the language. It could have been worse. The downside risk. We have this tendency to live in the future in fear. The future is always about fear.
Yeah.
We've never been there before, so it's a fearful place. And we conceive of the boogeyman in the dark of the unknown. where regret is always about the past. No matter how good the past was, it always could have been better. I regret. Actually, I heard the thing that the only regret is the things that you haven't tried or you haven't done. Those are the regrets. But my dad is like that. He's 91 years old, and he lives in his regrets.
Wow.
It's sad, that state of affairs. Yeah, it's sad. I mean, I could barely talk to him for more than 10 or 15 minutes, and, I think dementia's starting to set in a little bit. So it answers the question, if you have dementia, but you've had a really bad life, is it a blessing or a curse?
That's interesting.
You didn't remember. Yeah, you don't remember all the bad stuff. So it's all brand new. I heard Dr. John Keating, I doubt if he's still alive. He was a Travestine monk, and he started the contemplative prayer movement. It was something he resurrected from a monk named Benedict in the 10th century, praying or meditating on some scriptural reference or some spiritual enlightened phrase or something like that. And it was very powerful. And he was going into either dementia or Alzheimer's, where he was having difficulty keeping a train of thought. And I heard him, talk he was giving, and I was present, and he stopped and he couldn't get it back right away. And he said, I spent my whole life trying to divest myself of myself, and now it's happening for free. The guy was really sharp. I mean, even in the affliction, he had a humor and an acceptance. So once we're living in the past, we're in regret. If we're living in the future, we're living in fear. And what we're missing is the moment.
How many times did Jesus say, fear not?
Yeah.
Fear not. You know, as he approached the boat, walking on the water, fear not. He appeared to the apostles in their locked room after his resurrection. His first comment was, fear not. Let not your hearts be troubled.
Right. For the kingdom of heaven is within you.
Yep.
And I think that what he meant by that was that if you pass this veil and you're a happy person, you'll be happy still. And if you're a miserable person, you will be miserable still. And if you're a humble person, you'll be humble still. You know, so whatever you're going to bring with you, you already are. People think there's going to be this phenomenal change, like you're not going to recognize who you were. You can only bring who you are, kiddo, and what you know. That's it. We don't take any, we have no carry-on luggage.
Yep. No U-Haul behind the hearse.
No. My kids used to say, Dad, you know, you can't take it with you. I said, I don't know about that, kiddies. The Pharaohs really gave it a heck of a try. So, Harold, the next one would be we were unhappy. We were going to know a new freedom and a new happiness would be the promise. We were unhappy.
Yeah, I used to drink as part of happy hour, and we drink to be happy, and we end up miserable. That's what my experience was, Joseph.
Happy and unhappy. That's an interesting concept, and this is what I've considered. Unhappy and happy is about an immediate response to the environment. We're happy because something happened, particularly to me, that was pleasurable right now, in the moment, right? I'm happy this happened to me. I'm unhappy because something bad in the moment or something not pleasurable to me has happened in the moment. I'm unhappy. So these are reactions to the environment, whatever that might be. You follow me?
I do. I agree. And it also has to do with expectations. It's what happens in the environment compared to our expectation. If there's a gap there, then we have unhappiness. If what happened exceeded our expectation, we have happiness. And there's a lot of fuel for this discussion in the concepts of Buddhism.
Oh, yeah. But let me continue on with this. The happy being an immediate reaction. Now, we take the word joy. Joy is a state of being. You're joyful because you know all things work for your good, and you've accepted God and his will. That no matter what happens, this was God's will. Now, when your will and God's will diverge on a plane, and you'll say, well, wait a minute, I'm not really happy with that. But if you accept the fact that no matter what happens, if you did the next right thing and there was no expectation, you're joyful because you know this is God doing for you. And how often when we prayed, would we pray for something we wanted and got it and found that it was bad for us? Or we prayed for something we didn't want came to us and it turned out to be the best thing for us.
Absolutely.
Acceptance. Harold?
Yes, absolutely. And the interesting thing, I get to meet with a lot of families over the weeks and months, and what I find is that when people are on a search for happiness, it really boils down to a search for entertainment, various forms of entertainment.
Distraction.
But joy is much deeper than that, and it doesn't really depend upon outer circumstances or entertainment. It has to do, as you just said, with our relationship to God, realizing that when we realize that we are a child of God, that gives a tremendous joy, which springs from inside. Happiness tends to come from outside, and joy is an inside job. That's my experience.
It's an inside job.
Joseph.
we'll get the hang of this, Harold.
Yeah.
Maybe not this year, but surely by next.
Yes.
And no doubt about the year after. I think it's distractions. People are always looking for distraction. I'm always looking for a distraction. When I was drinking and drugging, I was always looking for a distraction. You know, what's the? You can't go home when the bar would close. You don't have to go home, but you can't stay here. Who's got the keg? Where's the next party?
There you go. Yes.
So
and
was I get more alcohol? Sure, it was, but it was also I didn't want to be with me. I wanted to be anywhere else but with me.
Escape reality. Yes.
Yeah. So it's a distraction. It's either an addiction or a distraction. If the distraction gets to be pronounced, it becomes an addiction.
There you go.
You can't stop something. You can't stop something. To stay away from the moment, because when you're alone in the moment, you're alone with yourself, and God says, be quiet and know that I am. So now if you're alone, oh, brother, that's a scary place to be. So I need to be distracted from microsecond to microsecond. I don't want to go into that neighborhood, and I don't want to go alone. Harold?
Exactly. That's just a picture of my addiction itself, escape from reality, never wanting to be alone, always wanting to be distracted. And one of my first sponsors said that you cannot actually search for happiness because it's like a dog chasing its tail. but if you will search for meaning and purpose, happiness automatically follows. And that was also my experience. Joseph?
The next one would be, we couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. And then the promise would be, no matter how far down the scale we have gone, well, we'll see how your experience can benefit others. We will not regret the past, nor wish to shut the door on it. Harold?
That line from the Big Book has been at times a tremendous puzzle and at times a brilliant guiding light. The shutting the door on the past, regretting the past, it took a long time for me to get to the point where I didn't regret the past. I didn't want to shut the door on it because my experiences, my past experiences, became a place of common ground where I could connect with some other people. Some people have had experiences similar to mine. When I share my experience, then it opens a door for them, and that connection, as we share our similar experiences, really defines helping in its true sense. I found that I had to sort of redefine the word help. Because there were many times when I thought I was helping friends who had addiction, friends who had drinking problems. I wasn't helping at all. I was actually hurting them and didn't know it. So by simply sharing experience, strength, and hope, that's when we begin to help. All this other stuff is ego-driven. That was my experience anyway. Ego-driven, didn't really help. It just made the problem worse. What do you think, Joseph?
I like the poet says, no matter how far down the scale we have gone, we can see how your experiences can benefit others. So you could either read it this way, the further down the scale you've gone, the more of a help you will be to others.
There's some truth to that.
So the hard knocks, those experiences that would kill most people, alcoholics are very tough people, addicts are very tough. I know alcoholics are for sure. Well, now all of a sudden they know what the other guy went through. That's why we don't close the door. It's not like, you know, we forgive and forget and we become new creatures in Christ, and that happens to some, but we don't want to lose the information that was so hard to come by, that now that information could be a platform for someone else to step on our shoulders to get a new life. What a great thing that is. When I tell sponsees and they really feel like, you know, that the beyond redemption kind of thing, I says, you don't get it. I says, all these experiences are for your own good. These will broaden your understanding, and you'll be that much, you're going to find a sponsee that's going to have the same experience you did, and your experience will help him like no one else can. So
that's
we don't
it.
Regret what happened. We can't go back into the past. What's about why would we regret? That has nothing to do with regret. We did what we did. It is what it is. So we take what we can and we give it to the next man.
Yes. Who was it that...
You don't shut the door. Well,
who was it that said self-forgiveness is giving up the hope of having a different past?
Oh, yeah. I don't know. I was working with Joseph. Working with a sponsee. Yeah, thank you. I was working with a sponsee one time, and he was struggling with with that, and I read in the big book, and it's like one of those things I had never read before. Yeah, you ever get those things, like you work with somebody else, and you read something in the big book, and you go, I don't remember this being in there. When did they put this in? You know,
yeah.
Harry Truman says, after you know it all is the time when you really start to learn. It was like he was talking to me. And it was about sometimes we relive the past, like somehow, some way we were going to change it. And that's back to my 91-year-old father who lives in regret and just keeps regurgitating all these sorrows and all this pain, like somehow, some way, he was going to be able to change it by reliving it from nanosecond to nanosecond. And not only is he's killing the present, he's also destroying what's left of his future.
Harold. Yes, and casting a dim light on the past, destroying the present, and effectively avoiding the future. Wow, all three wrapped up in that one exercise of rehashing things that he can't change anyway. That's really sad.
It is, and it's parente familia, my father, head of the family, and it's one of the ways to stay young is to have the ability to learn from your children.
That's beautiful.
And he doesn't have that ability. Now, I know that. So when I talk to my kids, I try to school them. But in the final analysis, our conversations do well when they teach me.
Yeah, when they teach you.
Yeah,
wow.
And that takes humility. That takes a lot of humility, and sometimes it's more humility than I can suck up. But it, you know, you're like, hey, kid, I've been around. I've been a combat veteran. I've been married 3.5 times. I've suffered losses that most people don't get to loss. I've made and lost several fortunes, and you're going to tell me which way the world turns. You're going to tell me where the bear shit in the buckwheat. That's my thought. But my
hog the cabbage.
Yeah, really. But the thing is that humility is about when every man becomes your teacher, and youth is become when your children become your teacher.
Yeah.
So I got a visit with my daughter on Wednesday, and I'm saying this particularly so I remember that. I tell people in meetings sometimes, the most important thing you might hear in a meeting, a recovery meeting of AA or any of the 12 or a sister fellowships, is sometimes the most important thing you'll hear will gingerly fall from your own lips, reinforcing a positive attitude in recovery.
That's great. That's a great quote. Well, let's see. We've got 7 minutes.
And we got and
have you given the call-in number recently?
You know, I never did. I didn't feel like talking to people tonight.
Then I had it written down.
I had too much to say. Hey, you don't want to call it. It's okay. As a matter of fact, I'll have to play this back a couple times. I'm only kidding. Here. Okay. And most of all, we will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. That's the last promise. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Harold?
Well, that is my favorite one. And the amazing thing about it is that I was such a stinker, and God was doing for me what I could not do for myself. I mean, he started that way, way before I really got things solved or cleaned up my mess, or that's the interesting thing about these promises is that they begin when we're still really mess ups, and we're still messing up a lot of things. Thank God in the 12 steps it says progress, not perfection. So here I am messing up 50-60% of what I'm doing. I'm still taking back control all the time and being a total jerk about half the time, and still God is doing for me what I cannot do for myself. You know, and in the scriptures, I was just studying a scripture that said he loved us when we were yet sinners. That's the same idea. God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves, and we're still horrible mess ups, and God is doing that. That's what's most amazing to me about the whole recovery process, and about it's to me, it's my experience, it's about God's love, and it is amazing. You know, I'm totally unlovable, and he loves me still. Joseph.
As no roads are so rough at those who have been mended, so no sinners are so intolerant as those that have just turned saints.
Wow. That's heavy. That's heavy.
Charles Caleb Colton. Here's another one for you. Got a couple minutes. Fear can be headier than whiskey once man has acquired a taste for it.
Ooh. It's kind of like tequila. It burns as it goes down, too.
We are more often frightened than hurt, and we suffer more from imagination than from reality. Marcus Aurelius Seneca.
Wow.
A lot of good stuff on the website, kiddo. Rumradio.org. You'll love it if you don't get anything of it. I'm sorry that you went blind.
It's a great website. I like the spirit of it. It's about working with others.
Pardon me?
I like the website. It's about working with others.
Yes, it is. There's a lot on there. I mean, there's a tremendous amount. I'm writing to the traditions, and there's good stories in there, and it's all programmed. We've had 1,018 letters from around the world. We're in 93 countries, and we're approaching 55,000 hits on the website. We're plodding along. You know, I would like more people would go to it. Some are refuse to do it because they've already made up their mind that it's not the big book. But the big book's in there, you know, but it's just in a different venue. So,
it's about
keep
book.
It.
Heaven's sake. Come on, everybody. It's about the
I
big
know.
Book.
It's a big
you
book.
Know, it's well, reading the big book.
Yeah,
Yeah. Well, it's been nice talking with you, Joseph. I'm going to sign off, and you're probably going to sign off the program for the night. Okay?
Oh, yeah. Well, very good. Thanks, Harold. And wait a minute before you – hold on just for a second here. And okay. All right. There you go. And let's see. Okay. Thanks, Harold.
Thank you, everybody. Calm down. That's great. I'm glad you found that. This was fun. All right, we'll see you next week.
Righto. Thanks, Harold. And we'll be signing off
on
here.
The radio.
And, remember, rumradio.org, the most comprehensive sponsorship website in the known and the unknown universe. The unknown universe. Yeah, we cover the planets, and particularly if you don't get any of this right away, check Uranus.
My favorite planet.
Good night, everybody. See you on the radio. RumRadio.org.
Good night.